And hi, and welcome, Bruce, and great to have you here.
It's nice to be here virtually. I wish I was there in person. I miss Germany. I miss Europe. I miss everywhere, let's be honest.
Well, next time you come, we'll treat you to Palatschinken and Wiener Schnitzel and to put something
I am
you.
So there, and I want some Sauerbraten, and I want some, want everything. Yes, yeah. That's right. And a nice beer hall. Okay. Yes, let's do it. Let's plan it.
Sorry. Now, on your website, I have to read, because we've had a little workshop, and we prepared some questions for you with the input of local here, and we gathered some questions, and I can ask you the first one. And everybody, of course, read your website and tried to read your blog, and you call yourself a public interest technologist. Now, I can sort of imagine what you mean by that, but would you mind to put some flesh onto that?
You know, I think this is actually a great question. It's not the best term. Where a bunch of us are trying to figure out how to describe techies like us who do policy work, who work either in government, at an NGO, for the press, doing policy-related technology, or possibly policy people who understand technology. And I mean, there are a lot of ways to engage. I see it as the recognition that all the major policy issues of the first half of this century are tech-related. And it's AI, and it's Internet of Things, and it's the future of work, and it's algorithmic discrimination. And a lot of the people doing policy, the lawmakers, the legislators, the judges, even the police, don't understand tech. And that's bad. It's really bad in the US. It's not great in the EU. So we as techies need to get involved in policy. So the phrase we've used is public interest tech. All right. So maybe you're doing some kind of tech project with a public interest focus. Think of Citizen Lab, right? You're using tech to expose totalitarian government surveillance. Or think of what the US is doing. What the markup is doing, sort of tech-related journalism. What we're seeing in the U.S. with a lot of tech to look for election interference and malfeasance and errors using statistics and big data. So that's kind of what I'm thinking about. And it's really what I do. You look at my books and they're tech, but I have a lot of policy answers. I mean, here's the kind of law we need. Here's the kind of regulations we need. GDPR was designed by public interest technologists to some extent. Like in California, we have a data privacy law. We have an Internet of Things security law. The more those have technologists working on them, the better they're going to be for us.
That leads me right to the next question. Do you really think that, okay, we as techies should get more involved into politics? That I love you for that. Because I have a lot of discussions with my fellow techies, and some of them say, who needs them? And I say, you do need them. They're making our future, or they're ruining, or they're breaking it.
This is important. Good policy versus policy versus no policy. It's good policy versus bad policy. They're going to do it whether we get involved or not.
Exactly. That's what I keep saying. They're going to interfere with you, no matter if you don't
right.
want to interfere
so
with them.
So we want to be in the room when they're doing it, 100%.
Do you think, I mean, when I look at the dimensions of how many lawyers Amazon has, or I don't know, Google or Apple or how about Facebook or Microsoft, we have good people. We have the EFF and we have people like Corey and others and who get involved. But do you think we stand a chance? It's a relation of 100 to 1.
Well, so we need to change the odds. We need to change those numbers. I mean, so lawyers is a good example. Yeah, there are a lot of lawyers at these big tech companies, but there are a lot of lawyers in government, in public policy organizations, who are working on law on the other side. Now, I teach at Harvard. I teach at the Harvard Kennedy School. So I'm teaching cybersecurity to public policy students, right? My goal isn't to make them cybersecurity experts. They're not going to be one of us. I want them to respect tech, understand enough tech to have a good bullshit detector, and want to call us when they get into office, when they're at an agency, when they're at an NGO. I want them to value our expertise. So, I mean, yeah, it's not balanced. There's always going to be more money, you know, on the side of corporate power. That's true whether it's tech or big oil or big tobacco or big pharma or anything. But I think there is this desire on the part of us, of techies, to make the world a better place. It's no longer true that we're just making toys. We're building a future. And we should have some say in what that future looks like. So I want to give one more story. Google invented a new job about 15 years ago, and it's product counsel. So what they realized is they would have engineers build something, get to the end, the lawyers would look at it and say, here are these problems, you have to fix them. They said, wait, let's embed a lawyer in the product design team from the beginning so that all through the design development process, they are someone who understands the legal implications of what they're doing. I want a policy person to do the same thing. A sociologist, right? Or a humanist, someone who knows policy and politics and who can be there in the beginning and say, hey, if you design this differently, it'll be better for democracy, better for liberty, better for freedom, for equality. And not at the end, but at the beginning. So, you know, here's a way that public interest techies can affect products, services at a corporate level. It's not unrealistic.
Well, we beat tobacco, to be quite honest, and we could do it again. Hey, I got the first question from the public here already now, and it fits perfectly. And it says, do you think that backdooring in crypto will still be standard in the next year? Is it coming? Where is that going? They're pushing in Europe. They're pushing. It's on the agenda of the EU. I know the States is always pushing for that.
States is always pushing. EU pushes sometimes. The UK is always pushing. Australia pushes a lot. And, you know, and then, of course, you go to totalitarian countries. They're pushing all the time. Right. India, Russia, China, you know, sort of all down there. I mean, I don't know. And again, this is a policy. This is not a tech question. Right? The reason we are here is because the policy people don't understand the tech. Right? They think they can build a back door that only the good guys can access.
Yeah.
Right? That's the problem. We need to fix that.
Security
versus security, this is a trade-off. Right? There is security value in putting a back door in this thing. Even though, right, it affects us, there's a security value in making this secure, even though it means we can't spy on the bad guys, right? Which is more important? I think, as a matter of course, we in society need to adopt a defense dominant strategy, right? That as long as this object is in the pocket of every single elected official and police officer and judge and nuclear power plant operator and CEO and voting official, that this must be secure, even though it also means the bad guys get security. Making this insecure so we can spy on the bad guys is too dangerous for the rest of us. But that is the tech argument, and we need to make it, because otherwise you walk into a legislator and they all think, well, you can only get to the back door with a warrant, so what's the problem? We know what the problem is. They don't.
You think the U.S. will ever have something like a GDPR?
So part of the U.S. does. California, right? That is one-fifth of the United States population, right? Has the California data privacy law modeled after GDPR. You know, it's not great. These are all compromises. Right now, on Tuesday, in 3 days, California will vote on an enhancement to that law, which fixes some of the problems to some degree. There are still more problems. So we're starting, right? New York, Massachusetts is thinking about it. At a national level, yes, eventually. it's hard, right? In the United States, there's a lot of money arrayed on not making that law pass nationally. And in the United States, money is very much political power. But eventually is a long time. So I think the answer is yes. No time soon. But the neat thing about these laws is that they affect outside of their jurisdiction. Right? You know, I get a lot of benefit from the GDPR, even though I'm not a European. I used to work for IBM, and I remember about 2 years ago, they announced, we're going to implement GDPR everywhere, worldwide, because that is easier than figuring out who is a European and who is not. Right? So California, right? California passed an Internet of Things security law. One of their provisions is no default passwords. All right, kind of a low bar. But you know, if a company that makes a digital thermostat gets rid of their their default password to follow this California law, they're not going to have two software builds, one for California, one for you, one for me. We will all benefit from that California law. So I don't need a U.S. GDPR to benefit from a GDPR. And that's kind of neat. So I actually look to the EU to really push these regulations. And I'm going to benefit anyway. I want the U.S. to do it. But the EU is a large enough market that it's going to move software.
Now, I'm not a politician. I'm a journalist like you.
Am I a journalist? Fascinating. Cool.
And I try to understand the world with my simple logic. And if I was to make a law on something that I don't understand, I'd go and ask at least one expert, if not more, to help me, just to see if I'm sort of, am I talking rubbish or am I just making a law that will end up in court because it will be challenged by every side? Why is it that politics doesn't do that? Why are we not more represented? Why don't they come and ask us? Why do we have to push them so much to listen to us?
I can really talk to the U.S. mostly because I know the system best. In the U.S., it's money and power. You know, we have a system that's very much run by lobbyists. So if you're a legislator and you're making a law that affects, you know, data privacy or affects pharmaceuticals, you're going to be talked to mostly by lobbyists, by people who have paid you money to get access to you. And lobbyists will tell you what to think, basically. You know, in the U.S., it's very much politics of sports. My side good, your side bad, rah-rah, and less about the issues. And there really isn't this appetite for what we would think as the natural thing. Let's understand the issue, figure out the right thing, and try to do it. That is kind of fanciful, but then the realities of money and politics, which in the United States is extraordinary for a whole, you know, for a bunch of complicated reasons that we in the U.S. particularly need a lot of money in politics in a way that most EU countries don't, most countries in the world don't. And that's the real reason why you don't see experts being consulted. I mean, even the United States, right? I think about this, the COVID pandemic. You'd think the doctors would be listened to. But in fact, in the United States, wearing a mask is a political statement, which is crazy. But that's where we are. And if we can't even get like wearing a mask and not dying to be something that you listen to experts, the hard stuff's going to be really hard.
True. And COVID is easier to understand than a DNS server. I understand that.
Yeah, yes, it is.
Not talking about encryption. Tell me, what do you think is the greatest danger to society from IT? Where is IT really putting us at risk?
You know, so, I mean, there are several. I'm gonna pull it out. Right? My latest book talks about one of them, with the awesome title of Click Here to Kill Everybody. And here I'm talking about it very much a computer risk, the notion that computers are affecting the world in a direct physical manner. Right? Internet of Things, cars, medical devices, thermostats, robotics. And that takes our world of computer security and moves it into the world of safety. right? It's no longer about data. It's about life and property. And I think that's a huge risk because we've built computer security around it's a spreadsheet. It's data. It's important, but it's just data. Ransomware against your car at speed is a fundamentally different thing, right? A DDoS attack against an embedded heart monitor is a different sort of animal. So I think that's a huge risk that we're kind of going into sideways as the same computers start getting connected to actuators, to sensors. Now, your refrigerator is just a computer that keeps things cold. Your microwave oven is just a computer that makes things hot. An ATM machine is just a computer with money inside. So I think that's a big risk. That's a tech risk. On the policy risk, I think the greatest danger right now are the tech monopolies. That the monopoly power of the big tech companies is just changing the way society operates. And I know EU has done more to block some of the monopoly actions than the US. US has done pretty much nothing, but neither of us have done nearly enough. And we need to bring back competition. And the simplest thing, I mean, certainly breaking up some of the monopolies is a good thing, but the simplest thing, which, you know, this audience will understand and no one else will, is we need open APIs for everything. The fact that these companies can close off their APIs is really an extraordinary power of lock-in, which would not have been allowed in the United States 40 years ago, 50 years ago. It wouldn't have. It would be like an automatic manufacturer saying, no one else can sell replacement parts for my car except me. Right? But in fact, your coffee maker with those little K-cups can say that because of the way software is. Right? And John Deere can say that about their tractors. And there's right now a bill in the Massachusetts legislature, United States, going to be voted on in 3 days, about the right to repair. Right? Do car owners have a right to repair their own cars without having to pay to get a special diagnostic system from the manufacturer to read the data out of the engine?
Whatever happened to the vigor with which the U.S. attacked monopolies? I mean, breaking up monopolies is basically a U.S. idea. You guys started it over there back in the 30s when we were still doing other weird things. What happened? Why did that disappear completely?
So it's interesting. I'm not an expert in this, and people have written about sort of what happened really since the 80s, since the Reagan era. And basically, the big companies got more power. And the monopoly, if you think about the monopoly actions, the big ones that happened in the United States, AT&T, which was sort of broken up at the moment that telephony became largely irrelevant, the internet exploded. And then the Microsoft antitrust action, which if you remember, you know, I think it was about their browser tie. And by the time it ended with a consent decree or I forget how it ended, but it was just sort of too late. It was obsolete.
It ended in a consent decree, and it was while it had about 30% of the market. Yeah.
Right. So it didn't matter. But things are changing. You know, traditional view of monopolies is that they raise prices. But Amazon, which is a monopoly, keeps prices low. Google, which is a monopoly, doesn't charge for their stuff. So monopoly is now more about power and extending power and using different things to play off in other things, right? So Europe, you guys fine Google for tying their search results to their own commerce system, right? Using their monopoly in search to increase their market share in commerce. Now, US let that go, but it was the EU regulators that fined Google, I think, like a real amount of money, not just a joke amount of money.
A real amount of money, yep.
Right, for doing that. Right? So monopolies work different today, right? It's Amazon controlling the market, also having the products they're selling, also controlling the cloud infrastructure that their competitors are using, and then using those three businesses to help each other.
I would contradict you in one only point. Google does charge you something. If you're not the client, you're the chap on offer. You're the wares.
But Google's customers, which are their advertisers, do pay, right? I mean, yeah. And I always joke when people say there's no Google customer service. And of course there is. You become a customer and you'll get it.
Yeah.
And customers are advertisers. Yeah. We're the users.
We're the product. We're the product, exactly. And nobody understands that. That's a big question, yeah? By the way, do you think we kicked out, or Max Schrems killed, I think, the privacy shield. Will that push more privacy in the U.S.?
I don't know. It's really interesting watching all of these U.S.-EU compromises be proposed and then fall apart and be proposed and then fall apart. Because fundamentally, the U.S. and the EU have different laws. And Facebook can't follow European law with its U.S. system. It can't. So I don't know what Facebook's going to do. Right now, they're sort of threatening to say, okay, we're going to pull out. So there's this power, right? There's this power play between the EU and Facebook. And I think this will be interesting. We're going to see who's more powerful, the government or this large, you know, global corporation. And I don't know. I think in the end, Facebook has to blink. Right? Facebook has to follow the EU law if they want to be in the EU. I want that. I like that. I think that's good. And then the question is, what will they do worldwide because it's easier? And what will they do only for EU citizens? Because the EU law applies to everybody in an EU country plus EU citizens wherever they are in the world. Now, that's kind of a hard thing to differentiate. And if you're building a network, it's hard to divide people into, right, you know, covered under the EU law and not covered. Because it could be someone in the United States on a trip or maybe staying for a couple of years or maybe staying here for a decade but still being an EU citizen. And that's hard. So I don't know what Facebook and other companies are going to do. It is really interesting to watch these struggles. I think they're really important. I don't think we give them enough importance.
I have a question from this internet thing here.
I've heard about the internet. It's going to be a big thing someday.
No, Ron Sommer, the head of the mobile phone in Germany, said 15 years ago, it won't, we don't need that. It won't be. Anyhow, how to explain to the typical user that he really wants to own a RISC-V-based computer to have full freedom instead of something with Intel management engine, when he not only doesn't care about facts, but he doesn't understand them. And he doesn't even wear a face mask to prevent from getting sick. I mean, where do you pick up those people?
So you can't convince them, but I think that's okay. Right? The notion that you have to be an expert in the thing to do the thing is wrong. Right? I mean, so I haven't done it in 6 months, but I remember I used to get on airplanes all the time. I am not an aviation expert. I never inspected the engine, right? I never looked at the safety record. I never checked the training of the crew. Never. Right? I was able to get an airplane without any worry, knowing that there were some government regulations that ensured the safety of the plane, the flight, everything. But I could walk into a pharmacy and buy anything, knowing it won't kill me. I can walk into a restaurant. Remember restaurants? Know that the food won't poison me. Right? Cars. Sort of in all aspects of our life. What we do is we delegate expertise to some government authority so we can do the thing safely without worry. Computers have to be exactly the same. Right? You cannot have it so that the users understand security, understand reliability, understand any of these issues. It has to be that out of the box, these systems are designed to protect privacy and liberty and freedom and security and all of those things, just like every other aspect of our life. And this is why regulation is so important. Like we don't want to build an internet that is only for the experts, just like you don't want to build automobiles only for the mechanics. And that's new, right? I mean, the great story is that the the first cars were sold with a repair kit and an owner's manual. That was part of when you bought a car, right? You bought a bunch of tools and you bought a repair manual because you had to be a mechanic. Now you don't. I know nothing about a car's engine, right? It's magic. It works. And that's the way it has to be for the internet. People who think the internet is magic, it has to just work for them.
Yeah, that brings us to another point. Now, we've talked about monopolies. Let's talk about trust, because that's what you were just talking about. And OxyContin, for instance, shows what goes wrong when people trust the pharmacy and the controls did not work, or the settlers had a good lobby job done so that nobody noticed. I think that technology is – people don't trust technology because they don't trust the government, and it's going down. Trust is eroding. Do you think we should work – we as the techies should work on that, and how would we go about it?
So I think that's really important. And the answer, of course, is yes. Right? I mean, all society requires trust. And trust is eroding in many institutions. But if you think about the amount of trust that you exhibit on the average day, it's amazing. I mean, maybe not in a pandemic, but, you know, I remember, you know, you could walk down the street and there'd be, you know, in a big city and thousands of people are walking by you and around you. And none of them would ever leap up and attack me. Now, it's kind of a joke, but we're the only species for whom that happens. I mean, you put a pair of 100 chimpanzees in a room and they're suddenly all fighting. So we as human beings have this capacity for trust that is amazing. And I talked about trusting the food we eat, the pharmaceuticals, the automobiles, the airplane mechanics and pilots, taxi drivers, sort of everybody that we trust. We are, certainly in the U.S., there is this mistrust of institutions. I've written about this, that, you know, we need this baseline of trust in order to argue about policy. So trust in the election results, which I think is going to be dangerous in a few days. Trust in the U.S. Census. In the United States, the census, the count, is used to distribute resources in thousands of different systems. It's like base numbers that we all have to trust. The judiciary, that we have to trust that there are people that will be fair arbiters of disagreements. And when we lose those areas of trust, society does be harmed at a very base level. And I think this is why the Russians are actually targeting deliberately those bedrocks of trust. I think we techies do have a role to play here, but largely this is social. Largely this is political, and it has to do with the way communication works today, the way memes spread, the way conspiracy theories spread, the way WhatsApp work and Facebook works and Twitter works. And these are hard questions. In the United States, we're very very strong on free speech, more so than in most EU countries. So anything we might want to do to fix this goes against free speech. But there are a lot of people, I mean, this isn't my area, a lot of people are thinking about this. But I think this is actually one of the big problems of the first half of this century. Early question you asked, what are the big security worries? I guess now this is a third. So yeah. I said Internet of Things, tech monopolies, and you know, the ability for misinformation to spread so wildly, so widely, so effectively is really very dangerous for society.
Well, I think we humans, especially this society we're having of the 19th and 20th and 21st century, we tend to develop technologies, and then only once the technologies are installed, we tend to develop social-cultural structures and methods to deal with those.
And that's naturally human. You know, really good at predicting tech change. We are terrible at predicting social change due to tech change. And I don't think, I mean, even you read the science fiction from the 70s, from the 80s, they got it all wrong. You know, if they were right, I'd have a flying car, and computers would still be the size of refrigerators.
Yeah, but you still have an iPad. That's the only thing. we got.
We got, but you know, it's really interesting that the notion, even the notion of robotics, you think about what a robot is in the movies. It is a metal shell with the intelligence on the inside and a bunch of sensors on the surface, and sensors and actuators. That's a robot. Today, what a robot really is the intelligence is in the cloud, right? And all that's on the inside are mechanics to operate the sensors and the actuators. That the web is very much a world-size robot, right? It thinks and acts. But, you know, we never realized that you could take all of the intelligence and put it somewhere else. So Data and R2-D2 and all of those movie robots, the intelligence isn't encapsulated. Right? You know, we thought about Star Trek sensors, right? This thing knows the temperature, but it has no thermometer in it because it gets sensors that are elsewhere and just tells me the temperature that other sensors somewhere in this city, right, have sensed. That's really neat, but no one predicted it.
I see. I mean, I totally agree with you, basically, and I'm quite glad that some of the science fiction got it wrong. Although the law of robotics is still a cool thing, I think I would like that. Yeah, but the Asimov was, I think he's best.
So there's a lot of people write in the philosophy literature how the three Asimov's three laws are woefully inadequate. There's lots of examples where it just doesn't work. So if you're interested, even anyone listening, go look up the critiques of the three laws of robotics. Turns out it's way more complicated than that.
I got this. Now there is this argument between Shoshana Zuboff and Cory Doctorow. What is worse, surveillance by surveillance capitalism, or the growing power of the IT monopolies? Now I know Shoshana and Cory have gotten in each other's hairs, so to speak. And I do know that you have an opinion because you blogged about it. What is your opinion? Would you like to mention something here?
So I don't think I should have to choose. I think I could worry about both, and that's okay. So I do think Shoshana is right that surveillance capitalism is a new form of capitalism. We talked about this about tech monopolies, and that is it is particularly dangerous. I think Cory is right that monopolies themselves are very dangerous. I think Cory makes some good points about the limits of surveillance capitalism. I think Shoshana is right that the techniques are going to always improve. And even though there are limits, this is fundamentally dangerous to liberty and freedom and democracy. So I think they are both right and they should stop fighting. And it's okay for us to pursue multiple policy goals at the same time.
True. I have a question from the internet from outside. It's a bit complicated. I'll just try to read it. Could you confirm that we should expect that the devices, food planes should be trusted and safe? But why don't the people want to be able to check if their trust is fake and scammed? Why don't they care about?
And I can answer that because they don't have the expertise, right?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, why don't I check the maintenance log of the airplane? Well, one, I'm not allowed to, and two, I don't even know what to look for. I mean,
FAA, to be quite honest.
Right. I mean, why don't I run my own tests on over-the-counter pharmaceuticals I buy from my drugstore? I mean, why don't I go into the kitchen of restaurants and do my own health inspection? Why don't I test the safety of ladders or of the brakes on my car or that the pajamas I buy won't catch on fire? It's so many things. And the answer is I'm busy. I got a lot to do. I don't have the expertise. And I have no choice but to trust society. I mean, yes, we could talk about all the ways this goes wrong. 737 MAX, complete disaster in government oversight of Boeing. And the Sacklers and the whole opioid crisis, complete disaster in the government oversight of pharmaceuticals. And, you know, there are occasional health breakouts at restaurants, but these are exceptions. Most of the time, this works, right? You can get onto a U-Bahn or an S-Bahn car and not have to check the brakes before you get on. Because if you had to, society would fail. So we have no choice but to build these systems so that the average person doesn't have to be an expert in order to use them. Like, we have no choice. We cannot teach everybody to be an internet expert.
No.
And if we did, get in line, because they have to be an expert in 1,000 other things as well.
When I was a young man, I was a Trotskyist at very left, and I had as a slogan, don't trust anybody. Now, as I've grown older, I've come to understand, same as you, that it doesn't work without trust. But we have a question here from the internet that I assume is from somebody younger than we are, because it says, how do you build a trust system when you can't trust anybody?
So you have to, you have no choice. You must trust people. You have no choice. And even that person who wrote that is going to eat food today that was created, packaged, shipped, stored, sold by thousands of people. And that person is going to trust that none of them poisoned the food. That person is not going to test it. So we have to trust. We trust thousands of times a day. And the fact that we don't think about it really shows how pervasive trust is. And I did a book on this as well. I don't have a copy here. It's called Liars and Outliers, where I talk about trust and how we facilitate trust. And it really is, I mean, I sort of recommend it to people who are listening to what I'm saying and saying, how does this work? I talk about how trust works and how we maintain trust in an environment where people might not be trustworthy. And there are lots of security mechanisms that we can describe that we use in order to ensure that our trust is not misplaced. And some of them are technical.
Now, finally, we're coming slowly, slowly to the end. Some more questions. Let's have some techie questions here now.
All right, I'm ready.
How about some new algorithms in encryption? Is there anything on the horizon, anything important happening?
The only thing important happening now is the work being done on post-quantum cryptography. I mean, really, algorithms are good. We don't need a lot of work. We need work around the algorithms, right? The math is the most secure thing we've got. It's a software that's terrible. But there is right now a competition going on in the United States. NIST is running it. On post-quantum algorithms, so algorithms that will be secured against quantum computers. And it's being done at the right time, right? There's no chance we'll get a quantum computer anytime soon. So having the encryption algorithms years, maybe decades before the quantum computing systems is better. So that's what's happening right now that's important. But otherwise, it's not about the algorithms. It's about using the algorithms.
Sorry, the internet is coming in, and this society thing is making people think. How much do you trust your own government? I think that's a good question.
So it depends what. It depends for what. I trust them for a lot of things. There are areas where we don't trust the government, but they really are the exceptions. So here, I mean, right, by politics is a mess here. A lot of things government does is untrustworthy. But by and large, we trust our government. You know, few of us live in a failed state where there is no government to be trusted. That even though, you know, the fact that we can trust the government so well as a baseline means we can talk about the things we don't trust.
True. True. And there's a quote, there's a question here that says, if everybody would check, we would check it out of order. We would probably break the system if everybody kept checking. I subscribe to that. Do you?
Would
you?
I think a plane would never fly if we're all checking the engine.
Yeah. I have another complex question here. How do you want to change the system? Mean that we don't have to test it by us? Doesn't it mean we have to test it by ourselves? And what is it? Tell us what can we do to make a change? just trusting the government will not change it that much.
No, I mean, I want us to get involved in policy. I mean, we need our voices in government. I mean, there's a lot of aspects to this. I mean, either as advisors, some of us need to go work in government. Some of us need to, work with or for NGOs. We need to be involved in the press. We really need to have our expertise listened to. And this is hard because it's easy for us to say, oh, it's government. They're getting it wrong. It doesn't matter. But it does matter. So, we need to push for the policy solutions that we know are best and we know are correct, because our expertise is really important here. So we need to get involved in any way we can, every way we can.
Shouldn't we, that's a question for me. Shouldn't we use our expertise? I mean, we're the guys who are building the systems. If you don't write and run them, they can't use them. Isn't that a leverage? Couldn't we give it a push?
So it is. It's interesting to watch because even, I think about this in the corporate realm. Even the tech monopolies in the United States have to compete for us, right? For engineers, for employees. And when the employees of Google, I forget which, I think it was Google, staged a walkout, right, to protest Google's involvement in a particular military AI contract.
That was Google. Yeah.
Company noticed, right? When employees walk out to protest misogyny, the companies notice. So we can organize as workers, as employees, and have an amazing amount of influence, even though these companies are monopolies. I think that's really important.
You know that we have an open source movement, but free code is not open source, as Corey explained when he was here. We have this movement here that says if a government pays for a code, it should be public because it's public money. What is your attitude to that?
That makes perfect sense. We have that problem in the United States as well. A lot of proprietary things being used for public purposes. I mean, right now, our worry is voting machine software, right? It's all proprietary. We don't know how it works. We don't know how secure it is. We have trouble auditing it or even looking at it. And that's dangerous, right? We know in this community the value of open source for security. And whether it's voting machines or breathalyzers or AI algorithms that predict recidivism and thereby set bail and parole, right? These are very dangerous systems when they are proprietary. Right? Have to convince others of that, right? Because the argument you hear is, if you make it open source, the hackers will attack it.
Yeah, right?
We know that's a dumb argument.
That's a load of bull, yeah.
Right, but we have to explain that to everybody else. That's our job to explain that.
Great. Will we still have privacy in 10 to 15 years?
I think, of course. Right, I'm still wearing clothes. You're still wearing clothes, so yeah. So yes. I mean, privacy is changing, but privacy is very much a fundamental human need. Right? It's a need to control how you present yourself to the world. Now, this is, and it's so core human that I can't imagine us not having it.
Okay, last question. We're on 47 minutes. Thank you very much. Do you still play Pokemon Go?
I still do. And so this is we can talk about this in terms of privacy, right? This is about us making trade-offs because Pokemon Go is a surveillance-based game. I still play, and I still play on my phone. And I should tell the everybody who's watching, if you want to become friends, email me your friend code and we can trade gifts. So yeah, I do. It keeps me sane. It's something to do that isn't, fighting against the world's injustices. And you need that sometimes. So, yes, I still play.
Bruce, it was great having you. And I support you. I think, yes, basically, I'm deeply convinced that we should go more into politics and we should get more engaged. But we're still having the argument over here. I think you're having the argument in the U.S. as well. Within the
We are, but
yeah,
we have no choice. We need to do it.
Yeah,
occupy government.
Yeah, I'm, right? I'm
become,
with you.
Become the government you want to see. That's our answer.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, we'll mail you when this is on air. Thank you very, very much for coming, for joining us.
All right, next year in person.
Yeah, I hope so. And while we're at it, keep in mind that all this is done by people have taken a week off from their job to volunteer here. People have worked from February on every 3 minutes to make this thing happen.